You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot smaller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I am Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Kate, how you doing?
Hi, Chad.
Fresh off a taping of His and Hers, Kate.
Yep.
How does it feel to be on TV?
And, you know, burn down the highway back to you all.
Excellent.
So much better to be here at this table.
Absolutely. You know? Neil.
Hey, Chad.
When are you going to host His and Hers? When are you and Kate going to do a little buddy comedy to him?
It's a great question, And also, why are you wearing a Mets hat? I just...
That answer is self-evident. I don't have to justify my hat choice.
Why are you wearing that Mets hat?
It's my game hat. We'll get there.
I wish the listeners could see this hat.
It's my game hat. It's done me well.
All right, we'll talk about it.
I'm 6-1 this year at Citi Field. Okay, so that, of course, is Neil Payne, sports writer for 538. Today's show, we're going to talk about the Women's World Cup on Tuesday night. We're recording this on Tuesday, so you may be listening to this after the World Cup happens, but, you know, use your imagination. So on Tuesday, the U.S. is going to play Germany in the semifinals of the World Cup. Alison McCann will be here to discuss why it's the greatest women's soccer match of all time. Then we'll don our all-whites and talk to Carl Bialik about Wimbledon and whether a female coach has anything to do with how a male player performs. And then NBA free agency, does it even mean anything with this very weird contract or salary cap situation that's going on? And of course, Allison will rejoin us for Significant Digits. And real quick, before we get into the show, I wanted to welcome those of us who are listening, who found us from Hang Up and Listen, Slate Sport Podcast. They did us a real solid this week and put some of our NBA lottery conversation that sort of became like an omnibus, all three parts of it were mashed together. And we appreciate the guys from Slate from helping us out and putting us on while they were on vacation. All right, so let's get to soccer. Last week, we spent a whole segment fretting about the U.S. Women's National Team, and then they looked pretty good against China. Kate, you're wondering, maybe not.
Better.
They look better.
Okay. Better.
And so now comes the real test against Germany. Germany's ranked number one in the world. We couldn't talk about this without 538's Allison McCann. Allison, how you doing?
Good. Hey, Chad.
So where are you joining us from, Allison? Are you on the road in Canada?
I am. I am in Montreal, but it sort of feels like I'm in America with the number of U.S. jerseys out there roaming the streets today.
Oh, yeah, because when we talked about them, was it last week that they were just off the match with and now I'm blanking on it.
Colombia,
and those stands just weren't that full. And so, Allison, you've seen the attendance really pick up as you've gone along?
Yeah, I mean, I think Edmonton is maybe not the top destination for anyone, but Montreal is, you know, pretty close to the U.S., and, you know, this is a way bigger game. So it sounds like they were up to about 50,000 tickets sold and counting and just cruising around. People have got their jerseys on and face paint. It looks like it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, Edmonton was the outlier because when they played in Vancouver, getting back into like Seattle through that custom border was like a 5-hour wait. So they've traveled well, except, you know, like you said, Edmonton, just a little far north, a bit north.
So let's start with the basics about the match on Tuesday night. Allison, you had a hot take of your own on 538 Tuesday that this is the best Women's World Cup game of all time. What evidence do you have, Allison? Support your own hot take.
I know. Is it a hot take if I have data?
If you back it up with reasoned logic arguments.
Yeah. So this is the largest average WSPI, which is our, you know, Women's Soccer Power Index of any two teams to play at a Women's World Cup, which, you know, we were surprised to see. There's been some, you know, huge games, the U.S. and Norway and Germany and Brazil over the years, but this one ranks number one. And I wrote a little bit, too, how I'd gone to the 99 final, and in my mind, that was the greatest game of all time, but it's eighth on our list of greatest Women's World Cup games.
Which, of course, begs the question of why it's the semifinal. And I know there's a lot of conspiracy theorists.
A lot of people in France asking that right now.
Right. And a lot of people feeling like FIFA stacked the deck in favor of hopefully what they hoped was going to be a Canada-U.S. final. That's obviously not going to come to fruition. So that's it's one reason why we're seeing this match of epic proportions being played in the semifinal.
And what was interesting when I was reading Allison's piece was that, you know, we think of those teams in the 90s from the U.S. as the pinnacle of giving us female folk heroes in sports and things like that. But actually, this team, along with the German team, this is a better narrative, if you will, a better matchup. It's a more compelling one than even the ones that we remember so fondly. And it really suggests that a lot of this stuff gets made in hindsight, that if the U.S. is somehow going to, you know, beat Germany and go on to win, that then we'll look back at Lloyd and Wambach, or yeah, in this case, Rapinoe and whoever else, and think so highly of them then.
Well, have you ever visited your elementary school gym and been blown away by how small it actually is? That's kind of what happens there in nostalgia when you look back. Because, like, women's soccer now has just grown so much that it was fledgling then, and now you have, like, really hyper-competitive teams, which leads to a matchup like this.
Right, yeah, maybe this is as much of, as anything, a function of how much better the U.S.'s competition has gotten, that perhaps, like, the rest of the world was rated lower, and it wasn't even possible to have a matchup of this magnitude in the past until, you know, recent seasons. What do you think about that, Allison?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, obviously we're just defining greatest game of all time as strength of teams. You know, there's obviously the U.S.-Brazil game in the last World Cup. I can think of great games of overtimes and last-minute goals. But and just in terms of the quality of these two teams, it will be the best we've seen at a Women's World Cup.
So remembering that some listeners will have already seen the match that we're about to discuss, I think we should break down a little bit what's to come in this match. The New York Times had a great interactive type of thing showing that this is really a match of offense versus defense, that Germany rather remarkably has scored a goal for every 6.7 shots that they've taken on goal, whereas the U.S. is at 9.7, but the U.S. has only allowed 12 on target shots this entire tournament, and Hope Solo has only had to deal with 12. And so, Allison, as you're watching, especially in person, are you anticipating this game to break down along those lines, or do you think that there's something that's part of this matchup that's being lost in that oversimplification?
No, I mean, I definitely think the U.S. defense is our strongest aspect, and the German offense, which kind of combines, they play in this 4-2-3-1, which is really interesting. So they almost have four attacking players coming at you at any given time, which has been, you know, super difficult for teams to defend against. So I do think that matchup is going to be really even and hard, and it's going to kind of come down to what goes on in the midfield, because that seems to be, again, the big question mark for both the U.S. and for Germany. You know, one of their star players, Jennifer Marzozan, I think if I'm saying her name probably really wrong, but she might be hurt, and we don't know what's going on in our midfield, if we're, you know, we've got our starters back, but if we saw last game, some of those subs came in and made a huge impact. So I think that the midfield still will be like where this game really matters.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting. One of the most interesting moments will be what the starting lineup is for the U.S. because they put a team on the field that improved the quality of their play, but that came when Lauren Holliday and Megan Rapinoe were forced out of the lineup because of yellow cards. And now, of course, Rapinoe's going to be back in the lineup, and you would assume Lauren Holliday is going to be back in the lineup. But, Allison, of course, it was Carly Lloyd, instead of being forced back as a defensive midfielder, being allowed to, like, roam up at the front and be a little more ambitious in some of the chances she was taking. Like, that's where she's at her strong suit. And hearing the coach Jill Ellis talk leading up to it, saying like, well, we hope we can keep that going. It's like, no, you're the coach. Like, you're the coach. Make sure that the lineup that we have can continue being more of like an aggressive midfield. I don't know how you feel about that, or like what players you hope we see in that midfield tonight.
Yeah, I thought Morgan Bryan was excellent in the last game. She sat in that defensive mid role. She kept the ball really well. You know, Carly gave it away a couple times, and Carly did end up scoring, but she's not as good at keeping possession as Morgan Bryan is. And I also think, you know, Germany's forward, Sausage, you know, she's been the leading scorer of the tournament, 6 goals. She's just insane, and she likes to kind of sit right in that spot between, you know, the defense and the midfield. And if we don't have a defensive center mid there, you know, she'll be all over the place. She'll be running at us, and so I personally wouldn't want her to be left alone. I would want to have whether it's Brian or Holiday or Carly, but somebody definitely sitting as a defensive center mid.
Now I've heard multiple takes on how Amy Rodriguez played, because she obviously missed that chance, that point-blank chance maybe another forward would convert, but she's also seemed to be creating more chances. She was off sides a lot, so there's all this back and forth.
And LaRue
about,
hasn't exactly
no.
acquitted herself well.
And Abby as well would be another option there. She's kind of been hot and cold as well. So what do you see or hope at those forward positions?
I thought Amy Rodriguez was awesome.
Okay.
She did miss that goal, and everyone will remember that. But we were creating chances. I think it was 13 chances created in the last game, which was more than any other game of the tournament. And I think a lot of that had to do with how much she just hustles and wins the ball back. And, you know, a lot of good stuff comes from her, even if she's not the goal scorer. So I would like to see her in there, you know, if not starting, definitely as a late sub to just come. And she just hustles. She runs everywhere. She's so good. I think high pressure will be really key for the U.S. To, you know, pressure the defensive, Germany's defensive back line, and, you know, put high pressure again like they did against China. You know, really plays to the U.S.'s strong suits, which are being, you know, the fittest, fastest team out there.
And Allison, what you just mentioned actually brings us to this segment's hot take, and this is from Julie Foudy talking about what the U.S. needs to do with their formation and their pressure in order to win against Germany.
We have the fittest team, the deepest team. We've got to go.
Why haven't we seen that?
I don't know. It's this sit-back mentality that's been driving me nuts, if you can tell. But we've been sitting back too deep defensively. And offensively, we've got to be pressing. We've got to be going high, pressing defensively, winning the ball higher, getting in line, facing up, all these things that are the American trait.
So that is sort of what you're talking about, Allison, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think play to our strong suits, which are the wingers, and they'll be wide open and pressure high, get the ball, you know, pump good crosses back in, and that's where we'll be able to break Germany down, I think, is the wings and pressuring high like we saw against China.
It also was interesting to me, the American trait, as though there was like a way that this team plays by its nature. And we've seen that a bit in other sports, right, Neil, where like you talk about the team's identity or something, and like how players are, if they play outside of that identity, maybe they're playing worse because of it. We talked about this in college basketball too.
Yeah, it does seem like certain programs seem to have certain identities. I think we talked about Michigan State, whether mm-hmm. this was a true Michigan State team that had gone to the Final Four. And it seems kind of strange if you're plugging in different players and you even have different coaches, especially in the case of the U.S. women's national team, that you would expect the identity to carry over through from, you know, very different iterations of the team.
Yeah, you would hope in the best programs, whether it's college or in this case soccer federations, like that idea of identity is not a very like narrow box. You would hope when you say that it's very, very loosely defined, so that it's malleable as you progress through different generations, that you can play differently. And so I think in a lot of ways that's what this team has struggled with, is like, is its identity, you know, based in all these ideas in the past, or can they bust loose of that and start arranging their players on the field to their strengths?
And it's also kind of interesting, like Allison, I don't know much about the history of the German team, but it seems like they are much better than they have been in the past. Are they playing to their identity, or have they like forged their own identity in this tournament?
I think they, you know, Germany has been getting progressively better, it seems like, as we're sort of flatlining, sadly. So, but no, I think that the German team has stuck to what they do really well, which is keeping the ball in the midfield and combining with this 3-1 attack. So, yeah, it seems both teams are going to be playing the styles that they're used to. I would be surprised to see the U.S., you know, change up or move their lineup around. I've seen people saying, well, maybe we should go to the same formation as the Germans. But, you know, I think it's too late. At this point, we got to go with what we do well.
In the lineup discussion, it seems to me like with Morgan Brian and with Rodriguez, both of them, this is their first World Cup. Is that right?
I think Amy Rodriguez has been at a World Cup before, but maybe not played.
So in soccer, you hear a lot about whether or not players need to get reps in the World Cup, because they're going to be in the World Cup roster 4 years later, and so you want them to get their legs under them now. And I'm curious for all of us to discuss whether or not we think that that has value or not, because we talked about it a little bit in the NBA, I think, whether or not the Warriors had to go to the finals in order first and lose in order to win the finals later. We saw that wasn't the case, maybe because they were such transcendent athletes, but whether this idea of reps on the biggest stage really matters.
So I'll do the first question, which was about sort of the way Germany sets up, and that leaves like our outside mids pretty wide open. And so I think having our wingers Rapinoe and whoever plays on that right side, Tobin, Kelly O'Hara, Kristen Press, are going to be really, really crucial, because they'll have a little bit more room to go, and that's where we could sort of break Germany down, is on the wings. As for the reps, I don't know. The World Cup is so crazy. It's only once every 4 years, so it's like a lot of people on this team will only even go to one World Cup, if you're sort of a fringe player. So if you're hitting your stride, which I think Morgan Bryan is, I don't know. I guess she is. Maybe she'll get better for the next one. But getting reps at a World Cup seems harder than, something like the NBA Finals, where at least you're back there every year.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, it makes me think about a lot of the way that the World Cup is, and the fact that it is so infrequent, and you have young players coming in and out. It kind of makes me think about like college sports, and you've got players that, are part of the future that you might want to give a chance, but then you have to balance that against the present. And I don't really know if there's any research on that about like, if you experience, especially in college football, where they really do have, years and years of players, being in the system, as opposed to college basketball, where the players who are the best prospects leave after 1 year and they generally get a chance to play. I don't know if I've seen any research on whether, an offensive lineman who gets to play against, Nebraska in as a freshman ends up being better for it when he's a senior.
So I did some quick Googling. Amy Rodriguez played in the first five matches of the World Cup in 2011, so I stand corrected. And Allison, I think we're going to wrap up here in a second. Any last thoughts about what's to come tonight, or for those listening tomorrow, if the U.S. women lose, what do you think it's going to be because of? Is it going to be because we can't put any shots on goal?
I don't think that's going to make us lose, because, I guess if you can't score, you can always tie, could go to penalties or something. But I think we'll lose if we don't stay organized in the midfield and we don't shut down Sausage and Mittick, who are just Germany's insane forwards. They've scored 6 and 5 goals this tournament, more than all of our forwards combined. So we got to hope that our defense plays as well, if not better, than they have the whole tournament.
I've heard a lot of people try and pronounce Sausage as Sausage, and it's really hard to tell the difference. So I think
the U.S. will find out how the sausage is made.
Hey!
Oh, wow.
Neil.
All right. I thought that we all were going to stay away from that.
I think that brings this one to a close. Allison, thanks as always for coming on and talking soccer with us. Hopefully we still have soccer to talk about next week. Well, we will, but hopefully we have U.S. soccer to talk about next week.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's leave it there. And now a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. Tonight, I'm going to a Mets game. I know the Women's World Cup semifinals on. I did not plan this well. My buddy who I'm going with is not a fan of soccer.
Then don't go. Like, it hasn't happened yet, so you could just not go.
I texted him before the show started. I said, "Do you hate soccer?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you hate soccer?" I said, "No, I actually quite like it."
So
we're
in
negotiations. We're in negotiations. All right. So assuming I go, it will be my 8th Mets game of the year. That's why I'm wearing the hat, people. And I went to 8 because I'm a delusional optimist. I'll probably go to 8 more by the end of the year. It's also one of my first Mets games of the year in which I'm not somehow using the SeatGeek promo code TAKEDOWN to get $20 off my tickets. I've run out of friends to see the Mets with whom I can ask to sign up for the new SeatGeek promo code because I've already used mine. And so I'm showing up to the stadium empty-handed in the hopes that some rich guy will take pity on my friend and I, give us a free ticket perhaps. Again, this is not how I prefer to do it. I prefer to go to SeatGeek, look at its fancy deal scores that it posts for every ticket that's available, and I prefer to trust in SeatGeek's ability to figure out the value of a ticket based on past precedent and where the market's headed. I like to use our promo code TAKEDOWN to get a $20 rebate off my SeatGeek purchases. But I've run, as I said, out of first SeatGeek purchases to capitalize upon, so I'll show up empty-handed, unsure of the deal that I'm getting on these tickets. You, listener, can do better. you can use promo code Takedown in the SeatGeek app, and that app and that promo code are your tickets to sports this summer. Let's talk tennis. It feels like the French Open just ended weeks ago, probably because it did. But already Wimbledon has begun. Here at 538, we barely think about tennis without Carl Bialik, let alone talk or write about it. And so to talk Wimbledon, here is Carl, one of our senior writers. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Chad. How are you doing?
Good. So, okay, set the stage for us. What should we care about going into this tournament? A couple days of matches have already transpired as we tape this, but what are the storylines that we should be watching coming out of the French?
Well, I think the most interesting one is on the women's side. Serena Williams has won the last three Grand Slams. If she wins here, that's four in a row. It's not quite as prestigious as the calendar year Grand Slam. It would be her second non-calendar year slam, which she calls a Serena Slam. It's still pretty damn impressive, especially because she's older than basically all of her rivals. So that's, I think, the most interesting overall storyline. On the men's side, we have a lot of different contenders and really no clear favorite, and all the top players won their first matches pretty easily. So we could have all of them advancing to the second week and a lot of great matchups in the second week.
Can we dwell on the Serena Slam for a second? It seems to me like that is as worthy as any other formulation of a slam would be. I don't care about calendar year. Should I? Like, it seems to me, if we're thinking empirically about the worth of an accomplishment, and we'll talk, Carl, I want to talk a bit later about how tennis doesn't quite have like a finals that you could win. Like, why do I care whether they're 1 in 1 year?
Isn't it kind of like a Major League Baseball player winning the Triple Crown? If he led the league 1 year in home runs and then another year in RBIs and then another year in batting average, it's not as impressive. So I think there is something to be said about within 1 year in all four of the different ones that offer different surfaces and all these different environmental concerns, you're at the top of your game in this one specified period.
Yeah, and I think we tend to focus in sports on the season as kind of a self-contained object almost, where it represents, especially since these are the tournaments that everyone is trying to win the hardest and kind of ramping up, you know, in their preparation for, that it displays a level of dominance that kind of shows that no one else in that particular year, none of your peers were able to really contend with you. And it makes me think of the Tiger Slam in golf, which is kind of the closest that anyone's come to this accomplishment ever in the professional ranks in golf, which he also won four consecutive major golf championships and didn't do it within a calendar year also. And so that's sort of like the Serena Slam, where you have to make this other designation to it to show that you've dominated four straight tournaments, but you left the door open for someone in the year in question to kind of steal your thunder.
I remain unconvinced, but I'm curious about whether Carl can convince me.
I want your thoughts, though.
So it shouldn't matter whether you start the year with a victory or there's a carryover effect. Like, this isn't poker, where the ace can't be a wraparound ace. It has to be the high card or the low card. Like, it shouldn't matter whether or not what matters is that you win four in a row. I absolutely agree with that. I'm not arguing otherwise. But what order those four come in, to me, the empirical, like the sober take on this is a player won four tournaments in a row. It shouldn't matter whether it starts with the Australian that's first or not.
Yeah, so the Australian is first, and I'm closer to Chad on this, I think, than the other two, just because tennis, like golf, is really different from the other sports. You don't really have like a defined season and then an off season, and you're winning the championship of that season. So if you've won four in a row, that 52-week period in which you did it is, for all intents and purposes, just as valid as the one that starts January 1st and ends December 31st. Whereas, you know, in the team sports, you have a season that starts and a championship that you're chasing from the very beginning. On the other hand, there is a history here in the sport of players chasing the calendar year Grand Slam. And because that arbitrary standard has been set and a few players have done it, that now has become the arbitrary standard. So it's kind of like, let's make this a little more difficult, or actually a lot more difficult, because you should have about a quarter as many of those as you have four in a row. So hey, that's something for Serena to still shoot for. If she wins here, it's motivation for her to try to win at the U.S. Open in a couple of months.
And Carl, it also seems like almost an individual versus team sport thing, where in a team sport, you may, you know, change the composition of your roster between seasons. And so it's not actually, you know, the Patriots team that won as part of that, like, you know, 20 whatever game winning streak at the end of 2003 that went into 2004. There were different parts. And so it felt less contained than perhaps the Patriots team that actually went the whole regular season without losing in 2007, just to think of an example.
Yeah, and Serena can't really acquire like a new left arm in between 2014 and 2015.
But there is a bit of an off season in tennis right after the U.S. Open, which is a slight delineation. Obviously, it's not quite the same as off seasons in other sports. But for athletes to go back and work on skills, and tennis players who have weaknesses to try and make them better. So you do see going into Australia, not the same as other sports, but players who are coming back as hopefully improved versions of themselves, which I think is a delineation when you're looking at what a Grand Slam means.
That I think is the most compelling thing, that you want there to be a beginning moment when the season begins, more or less. Right. In this case, there are four seasons because of different services, but or three, I guess. But it does feel to me like we're adhering to tradition and an arbitrary tradition when we shouldn't. And Carl, part of this gets at something we were talking about before taping, which is that tennis is a sport that does not have one pinnacle achievement. Or maybe the pinnacle achievement is a calendar year Grand Slam. But you can't necessarily say that someone is dominant in the way that you can in other sports. Even in perhaps golf is the only other one where there isn't quite this sort of final culminating tournament or culminating event that you can say for sure who the best player is. And so we rely on dominance to find the best player, and that dominance comes through four Grand Slams in a row.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this touches on what Kate said, that the season kind of ends with the U.S. Open. And I think to most people who pay attention just to the Grand Slams, it really does. But the funny thing is the women's tour and the men's tour, they both do have a season-ending tournament, which comes about 2 months after the U.S. Open, and only the top players qualify, and they play to see who wins that tournament. And in other sports, you'd say, oh, well, the winner of that actually wins the year. But you've probably never heard of it because it's really not anywhere near as big a deal as the Grand Slam. So it's a way that the sport kind of tries to overlay that structure and make itself more accessible for people who are used to the seasonal sports, but it's really not the determining factor. And neither is Wimbledon. I mean, Wimbledon's probably the most famous, most prestigious, but a lot of players say it's their biggest dream to win here. But if you win here, you could still finish the year ranked fifth or sixth or lower if you don't do much else. So there really isn't much besides what is your ranking at any given moment. And that person may not have won the last slam or even the one before.
So speaking of players whose dream it's been to win at Wimbledon, Andy Murray, hometown hero, finally did so a few years ago. And this year, there's sort of a fracas around whether or not his coach, Amalie Mauresmo, is somehow an inferior coach because she's a woman. So let's listen to Murray address the drama after a win at the Australian Open this year.
A lot of people criticized me working with her, and I think so far this week we've showed that, you know, women can be very good coaches as well.
So, Carl, does coaching matter in tennis? I mean, like, it seems obviously crazy on its face that there might be some disadvantage to having a cross-gender coaching pupil relationship. Maybe I'm wrong about that, and I'm happy to be told otherwise, but the larger question seems to be whether coaching matters in tennis.
Well, the question really isn't the crossing genders, because guys coach females on the tour all the time. Nobody even questions that. So really the only one we're questioning is whether a woman can coach a man. That's really the only thing that we're saying, is that an inferior relationship for Andy Murray.
Right. So Carl, does either of those things matter, coaching in general or a woman coaching a man?
Yeah, so to address the easy one first, it definitely should not matter, a woman coaching a man. What's funny is Murray today beat Mikhail Kukushkin, who's coached by his wife. So there are two players on court coached by women, one with a more complicated relationship than just a coach-player relationship. And there have been women coached by their husbands. So, you know, there are all sorts of categories that coaches can fall into in addition to gender, and it's really whatever works for a player. I think that the bigger question, the harder question is, how much does it really matter? And Murray's an interesting case because a lot of people in the sport attributed his breakthrough winning at Wimbledon, winning the Olympic gold medal and the U.S. Open the year before that to his coach, Yvonne Lendl, or largely to his coach. And I think if you look more closely at his performance, you could say, actually, Lendl came at a good time. Murray was probably nearing his peak. Some of his biggest rivals were probably falling off their peak or were injured. He'd had some bad luck in big matches before, and he'd had better luck in the big matches he won in terms of kind of how tired his opponents were, how hard their previous match was. So it's putting a lot on a very small sample to say that Lendl is the reason that Murray broke through. And if you look at other players who have famous coaches, because this is the big thing now in the sport, to hire an ex number one player, an ex champion to be your coach, which Mauresmo is. There's a lot of kind of ex post facto reasoning of this is why this player is doing this differently or why they're winning. But there are a lot of counterexamples that people just don't talk about very much, where a famous coach comes in and the player doesn't improve or even seems to do worse. So it's a fun narrative. It's also fun because the sport has so many familiar characters from the past, and it's fun to talk about them again and see them in the limelight. But, you know, in basketball, you can rearrange your roster and you can play the triangle offense and you can have some say in the draft. In tennis, you're working with a player who's pretty much formed at this point. I mean, Kate pointed out they can work on things and heal in the off season, but they're largely pretty formed adults with formed bodies and skills. And I think developmental coaches matter a lot, but their coach today when they're at their prime, I think it's highly overrated in the sport.
I think when I pay attention to the Murray Mauresmo combo and ask, like, well, does it matter that she's coaching him, that he picked a female coach? A lot of times the only reason it matters is because other people think it matters. And what you've seen with Andy Murray is having to talk about this a lot and having to answer questions about it and having articles in, like, the Telegraph, which I read earlier today, quote, introduce intuition and dampen down the aggression. Okay, which is such a reinforcement of what
coded
a
language.
Female coach might introduce, like some sort of woman's touch, and then like took down some of like the toxic masculinity level of it. But I do make somewhat of a correlation between what a male athlete will have to put up with, like in tennis, mm-hmm. if he does hire a female coach. So a lot of the way we talk about whether a gay athlete, whether that's a distraction, in a lot of ways within the locker room, within those teams, it doesn't matter. But there is this outside spotlight that you do need to pay attention to, because there is a burden to carry in Andy Murray having to speak about hiring a female coach again and again and again.
Well, and that gets at what we've probably will address at some point in this podcast in earnest, which is whether or not there's any research around whether distraction has any effect on play, and certainly does emotionally for athletes, or at least we assume it does, but we don't know if that translates onto the court. But one last thing on the way we obsess over changes in performance in tennis. I feel like we spent a month or two talking about Novak Djokovic's gluten-free diet at some point a few years ago. And like there, because it's such an ineffable game in some ways, we try and attribute cause or causality to any change in performance. And maybe it's that the player just got better. And maybe the coach could have something to do with that. The diet could have something to do with that. But we want this sort of one trick, like those internet ads where, you know, one simple trick lets you lose 15 pounds of belly fat or whatever.
That's totally what it is.
Yeah, we want that one trick lets you play 15% better in a Grand Slam tournament.
Although it is interesting that tennis is a sport that might be the most deterministic of all the sports, in the sense that you're having so much of a sample in each match, even of, you know, points that are won, that you can't really luck your way into winning that much unless it's like a super evenly matched contest. Right, Carl?
You're absolutely right within a match, but draws are very uneven. So you could just have the good luck of players being injured and out of the draw or being knocked out early. And even if you're facing a top player, there's a big difference between facing one who's been cruising through the tournament and one who just played a 4-hour, 5-hour semifinal a couple of days before. So I think that's where within the match, I think it's very deterministic, but in terms of how good the player is on the other side, that can vary a lot, and your coach can't really help you with that.
So, Carl, we have to leave it there. There were more questions that we wanted to ask you, including whether Serena Williams pulling out of the doubles tournament mattered for her long-term stability in the sport. You can think about that. We'll have you back on if she makes the finals. But as always, Carl, thanks for joining us and talking tennis.
Lots of fun. Thanks, guys.
Okay, moving on to the NBA. LeBron, LaMarcus, Kevin, Goran, DeAndre, It's free agency season, guys.
Yes.
Perhaps some of the most fun.
The best season of all.
Best time of year.
It just makes me feel like I'm playing a board game or something, and you get to just move the pieces
around.
I'm
trading baseball cards when I was 8 again.
Totally, totally. So this one, this free agency season, though, is particularly weird. And that's because the salary cap is going to jump from $67 million next season to $90 million the year after. And that's because of all sorts of TV revenue kicks in. And then $108 million the year after that. And so we see all of these players trying to game a system, basically, because the NBA is awash in money. And what I'm trying to figure out as I watch all this, and LeBron's opting out, Love opted out, who else?
Dwayne Wade opted out,
exactly, is whether what we're about to see happen in this offseason means anything about the players or the team roster construction or anything, or if this free agency season is so weird and so atypical that we can't really learn anything about teams' ability to get free agents or put teams together or anything like that.
I do think what I think I'll be paying attention to is because I think there'll be so many more guys going for one-year deals and then like one with a player option like that we really just didn't see when guys hit free agency over the last 15 years. It's like get that five-year, $100 million deal when we're talking about max players. But I do think that because of that, you're going to see that teams who are already structured to win or compete are going to have an advantage for these guys who want 1 or 2 year deals. Because before, it'd be like, oh, who's going to give me the most money? And on that long term, perhaps they can grow.
So you're saying a good player wouldn't take a max contract for a year, but maybe slot into a good team otherwise?
Because they don't want the max contract right now because it's going to tie them into less money actually over 5 years. So they're really going to be looking at over the next year or two, where can I go make this decent amount of money before I really cash in? But if I'm playing for that year or two, I want a team that is relevant now rather than going with a team that even five years down the road, you're like, well, they could be really good and I'll buy into that.
Yeah, and it's tough to stress exactly how weird this is and how unprecedented it is to have this, you know, the salary cap change by that much money between seasons. And there had been a proposal put to the players' union that they could do smoothing, which right. was kind of balance things out so that it wasn't so drastic. And the players rejected that proposal and wanted this scenario in which this particular offseason that we're in right now is such a strange transitional offseason looking forward to next year and the amount of money that people can get. And I think you nailed it, Kate, about how the demand for short-term contracts, which used to not really even be there, especially at the max level where you wanted to get locked in, and it gave an advantage to the existing team because they could pay more than any other team could. It remains to be seen how it's going to be eroded, but I think sitting here sort of in the calm before the storm, we surmise that it's going to have a profound effect.
And there's the added wrinkle, not just that there's more money, but then as guys get 7 years in the league or 10 years in the league, that they can get a higher percentage of the salary. So a lot of them will want to structure it so that they're hitting those marks when they're free agents to like fully capitalize. So there's like the wrinkle of the more money and then the wrinkle of guys who are hitting years service and what that means to their contract and everybody trying to measure it to that.
Yeah, and max money is going to be $30 million or near about starting next offseason. And right now it's still only about like $22 million. And if we think about like $30 million, even in the NBA, the research has long said that the best players in the NBA are pretty drastically underpaid relative to the amount of revenue they generate or even what they would make if they were put on an open market. And so this current offseason is still going to be a continuation of that. But then after that, we're going to see them get paid more like what they probably should have been paid all along.
And you know, like, because the market has kind of been what it's been for so long, you have in your mind, like, what guys are worth. You know, you're like, oh, Max Guy is going to make like 22. Decent, $8 million. This is like when the SATs changed their grading and their
it's
number
great
format.
Inflation.
Like now when young people are like, I got a 2200 on the SATs, I have no idea what that means. I don't know what Jeff Green is worth now. In this new market, is Jeff Green now, is he worth $18 million now?
It's like that if you got paid an extra $8 million to take the SAT once it went up to 2400.
It's like a lot of, with this new jump, like the dollar figures are not going to match up to what we have preconceived about player skill.
So I want to talk about the actual players a little bit too, especially Kevin Love, because Kevin Love is such just like a black box, it seems, especially in the last year. We spent a year obsessing over his body language and what LeBron may or may not have said to him in the locker room at some point. And it just seems like he is this guy who could be the missing piece for the Cavs, or maybe the Cavs only made the finals because they didn't have him, and as a result, because he's not under control of the Cavs anymore, Yakfest, like Sports Nation on our on ESPN, is trying to figure out what is going to happen with him and whether LeBron should have to recruit him.
This is just LeBron wanting Kevin Love to give him his pure desire and love of being in Cleveland. Hello.
No, he doesn't.
He wants Kevin Love, but he wants Kevin Love to want Cleveland in that situation first.
Like, I want you to want me.
I want you to want me.
I don't have to tell you.
I don't want to force you to want me.
So that was about whether or not LeBron needed to try and go after Kevin Love again, or if Kevin Love should be able to just come on his own and want to be part of the Cavs. And it brings up the question of sort of what the right move is for players, as we were talking about earlier, and for the teams. Should they be chasing the right fit in this new contract system, or should they, like, is Kevin Love, we thought was going to be a fit for the Cavs, but maybe not.
This is a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier, because I don't think Kevin Love would want to sign a 5-year, $100 million deal with Cleveland and play his prime in Cleveland. Now, under the old salary cap system, he probably would want to take that deal because he would want to have like that long-term security. But now there's like this perfect opportunity for him to take like a 1-year deal plus 1 year, win a title with the Cavs, get rid of that sort of cloud that hangs over him saying he doesn't, you know, he's not a winner, he's never going to win, get that championship, and then actually go sign wherever he like truly wants to be. And I think there's going to be a lot of guys in that position where they don't need the long-term contract. They're going to take the short-term contract with the team that can win right then and then wait for the big bonanza of money.
Right. And so I guess the stats are sort of missing from this conversation, I'm realizing, as we're talking about it, because this does seem to be almost the silly season where, like, the empirical stuff that happens are the agents and players trying to game the system, as we've been talking about, but less so about performance on the court a little bit, because there isn't an algorithm, Neil, that just fits a player into a team based on numbers.
Yeah, I mean, for some of the lower salaried guys, it does come down almost more to how they fit with the team that's going shopping in the free agent market and trying to fill like specific needs than like how good this guy is holistically, you know, as a total player. But I do think, you know, at the top we're talking about these max level guys. These guys are the most impactful players in the league if you look at, like, you know, their on-court, you know, real plus minus or any of those stats. These guys rank in like the 100th percentile, LeBron does, and a bunch of other guys in the 99th percentile. So, you know, that talent is what drives these salaries if you can get a hold of one of those players that's worth that much. But then, you know, lower down the scale, you do start to see players that maybe aren't as good of a fit for everywhere sort of having to slot in places that need them the most.
Well, where does LaMarcus Aldridge fit in that equation? Because I think we're hearing him this free agent season as like the cream of the crop. He's the guy. He is the number one free agent in this offseason. And, you know, some people would say, well, that's because the crop of free agents isn't what it's going to be next year. It has been in past years. But obviously, he's a great player. But where does he fit when you talk about, of course you're going to pay LeBron, of course you're going to pay this guy?
Yes, I mean, statistically, he's in the 95th percentile of all players, which means he's better than 95% of all NBA players last year, according to Real Plus Minus. But then you look at somebody like DeAndre Jordan, who was in the 96th percentile, if you look at his Real Plus Minus. And we think of Jordan as being a defensive stalwart compared to someone like Aldridge, who's more of a offensive, you know, face-up type of big man. And that bears out in the stats. But someone like Jordan, his offensive plus-minus is actually not that far behind someone like Jordan. So, you know, it's sometimes the stats match up to what your preconceived notions of these guys are, and sometimes they don't. And I think, you know, a lot of these teams have analytics departments now that are churning out numbers that are probably even beyond what's available publicly with the plus-minus. And it's going to be interesting to see how that shapes. That's maybe another wrinkle that we can add in is, you know, we're going to start seeing those numbers be the numbers that dictate some of the decisions that are made, instead of, you know, how many points, rebounds, and assists per game a guy had.
I mean, the one thing I would want a statistic for that I don't think we can have is the frequency with which guys who are set up for life-changing contracts actually do get hurt. because we always hear that, like, well, they better take that max deal. Mm. They don't want to play that next year, like Jimmy Butler right now with Chicago. He shouldn't want to take that guarantee, you know, that option that Chicago's thrown at him because he wants to lock in with this long-term money. But how frequently does that happen? Because
that's especially important now when some of these players maybe won't get a max contract in the new regime, but maybe they could now because of the salary cap going up.
Yeah, and then you look at like Wesley Matthews out in Portland. A lot of people like he's going to get a huge deal, but then he gets, you know, an Achilles injury, but he's still going to sign. I mean, is that even a legit concern for these players, or is it something just people throw out there like, well, he better get locked in?
Yeah, I think if you were an agent, you would want to have some of the same kind of almost like a projection system in which you could look at similar players and how much production they had and how much salary potential
they had. That
projection
system doesn't tell you projecting his Achilles, right?
No. I mean, there's no way to predict something like that unless you had some of the more advanced like biomechanical things that you're starting to see some teams take advantage of and players take advantage of. But just in the sense of like getting a vague idea of, you know, my future earnings potential versus my current one, you better believe the teams have systems to work that out. And so, you know, the players, hopefully they have the same thing and they're kind of fighting on the same playing field.
In the percentage chance that those injuries happen, so you can just look at it and be like 2.3% of the time this guy has gotten hurt. Is that a chance you want to take leveraged against all these other factors?
And that's one of the new frontiers that we're trying to
that's
get
to. That's
what
we're about
sports.
Here. It's just moving the
pushing
frontier and just like chasing it.
All right, so we'll probably end up talking about whatever happens in the end of free agency once we know where everybody went, and then Neil will have created a fit metric by then about how the players
absolutely.
Fit.
So next week you'll have that?
Yeah, that's easy.
Excellent. All right, so now let's bring in Allison McCann for our significant digit. Allison comes in every week to talk to us about one telling statistic in sports, and it explains everything. Allison, what do you got?
This is a fun one. This week's significant digit is 4, which is the number of times Luke Ridner has been traded in less than a week. He went from the Magic to the Grizzlies to the Hornets and now to the Thunder, it appears, which, you know, there's still time, I think. So, by my count, this is the most someone's been traded in the course of a season. I did some brief digging, and there was the NBA's most traded man, Drew Gooden, which he'd play for like, I don't know, 10 teams over the course of his 13-year career. But I think Luke is doing the fastest trades per day metric. But
right, his rate is really high. So one question I had: are you flattered if you're Luke Ridnour?
You're worth the right to be waived.
Well,
that's what's going to happen.
Well, you're worth enough that some team wants to take you on. That enough might be your contract or whatever, but you're an asset.
Your contract is an asset to be waived. So if that's what you're into. I mean, but what other time would Luke Ridnour be making an appearance on this show other than if he was traded? I don't know.
What you're saying, kid, is you want Luke to come on the show.
All those people who bought all those Ridnour jerseys and all those different markets.
Right, over the last week.
Yeah.
They should get refunds.
For just a couple days, they could use them. But yeah, it's interesting. I think it was John Hollinger years ago used to talk about certain players being part of what he called the trade zone, which was like you weren't really good enough to have people want you long term, but you were also sort of desirable enough to be acquired in trades. But I don't really think Ridnour really fully embodies that because, like you said, Kate, he's really, and this is sort of unique to the NBA because they have the guaranteed contracts and they have a lot of these weird CBA peculiarities that, you know, he's signed through the end of the 2016 season and he makes about $2.8 million per year. And if you want the cap, you know, to the logistics of fitting those Tetris pieces of contracts inside of your cap, sometimes it's really valuable to get a guy that you have no intention of playing and you have no intention of having anything except him being a walking piece of paper, basically. And that's sort of life in the NBA. But like you said, Chad, at some point, someone felt that he was good enough to give him that contract, even if it didn't end up paying off for them, that could allow him to become that walking piece of paper years down the road.
Now, is this zone sort of like the friend zone where
right.
The person's not good enough that you want to date them, but they're good enough that you want to hang out
with
them?
You want to be around them. Yeah, exactly.
So it's like the NBA version of that.
That's right,
okay.
Yeah.
So you got friend zoned, kind of.
Right.
But you know, his contract.
The real question for me, what jersey will he wear into the Hot Takedown Hall of Fame? Because he's got
he's
many
got
choices
a lot to choose from.
All right, Allison, thanks as always for bringing us our significant digit. We'll let you get back to the soccer.
Thanks, guys.
So that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
And to Neil Payne. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you, Chadwick.
Our podcast producer is Jody Avergan. Our video producer this week is Jordan Shulkin. Our intern is Asa Chaturvedi. Once again, thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring the show. Remember to use the promo code TAKEDOWN when buying tickets on the SeatGeek app. You can email us at contact@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to leave a review and or rate the show. Our music is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chad Matlin. I'll talk to you next time.
Jody Avergan from 538 here to tell you about our new podcast called What's the Point? The show focuses on how big data is changing our lives and features interviews like this one from Neil deGrasse Tyson.
By the way, we've been into big data from the beginning, long before anyone even knew the term big data. We have the universe we're measuring here.
Check it out. That's What's the Point on iTunes and at 538.com right now.